We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Day. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Pretty exciting week.
A lot going on.
For some people.
With the elections, yeah.
Yes. So that's where we're going to start out with, the elections. What the heck happened?
Well, let me start with the disclaimer that I've been helping to run over the past few months, which is why I haven't said a lot about it, the Shama Sawant campaign. And, boy, this has been a week. she, in her race for Seattle City Council against Richard Conlon, came in with 46% on election night. And, wow, that's historic. That's phenomenal for, you know, a grassroots socialist candidate who didn't take any corporate donations at all, et cetera, et cetera.
That's not what the media said. The media said, oh, Conlon cruised to victory.
Yeah, yeah. And,
but they spoke too soon.
And it was definitive. And even though we were saying, well, you know, actually only about a third of the votes came in on election night, and we have it on pretty good authority from the feedback that we've been getting that it's going to get better. And we made a conscious decision not to concede on election night, which was questioned quite a bit by reporters. Who were very dubious about our math, and guess what? We were right. So there have been 6 drops from King County elections since election night, 2 each Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, because they got so many late ballots that they usually only do 1 a day, but they've been doing 2 a day this week. So she got 46 on election night, and since then it's been 49, 50, 53, 56, 55, and last night 59%. Of the ballots counted, to the point now where there's only about 1,200 votes separating the two. Conlon is ahead. It was 6,000 votes on election night.
Yeah, that's an amazing ability to close the gap.
Yeah, and of course, with the current trend, there's we don't have an exact number, of course, but somewhere between 20 and 30,000 ballots left. So depending on how many are left, she needs roughly 53% to avoid a recount, 51 to 52% in order to win. And, of course,
so it's very possible.
Since Wednesday night, she's been routinely topping that. Now, the caveat to this is that when you get to the end of the vote counting, which King County Elections is close to now because most of the ones that they've received in the mail have been received at this point, since they're supposed to, you know, get things delivered in one day, although it doesn't always work that way for local mail. That a lot of what they're going to be counting starting next week, Monday's a holiday, so they'll start releasing these again on Tuesday, are challenge ballots, ballots where the signatures didn't match or there's other questions about validity. And so the Sawant campaign is holding trainings this morning and tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock at campaign headquarters, and I'll give you details on that when we get to a calendar item. To help people to literally, physically, you can get the address of challenge ballots from King County Elections and use voter databases to identify who those folks are. And I literally go out to their houses and say, you know, they're not counting your ballot because your signatures didn't match. Can we get documentation to make sure that your voice is heard? The Sawant campaign, because they had, 400 volunteers by the end, can do that in a way that the Conlon cannot. So they're looking very strong in that race. And I'll talk a little bit about the CTAC minimum wage initiative, which has been trending in the opposite direction, and what the implications for that process are for that. But you wanted to weigh in on the
Conlon race,
too.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something that I found really interesting about the Conlon-Sawant race is that the fact that the late returns are so heavily in her favor seems to indicate to me that the voters, my interpretation of that is that everyone who was strongly for Sawant probably marked their ballots and mailed them in early. People who were kind of sitting there going, oh, I don't really want to vote for Conlon, but Sawant's a socialist. I'll just wait and see if she does anything flaky that would disqualify her. And she never did. You know, and so I think a lot of people who waited to see if she was a crazy socialist, those folks kind of held on to their ballots until the last couple days. And when they saw that she was a credible candidate and that she did represent their values, finally did mark their ballot for her and mail it in those last 2 days.
Yeah.
That's my interpretation.
Yeah,
of it.
It's actually been a little more pronounced than that because there were a number of developments in the last couple of weeks that demonstrated that she had much broader support in terms of endorsements that she got and that sort of thing. So she really, as time went on in the closing weeks of the campaign, demonstrated a much broader coalition than was apparent early. So It wasn't just passive waiting for her to do something crazy, and she didn't. She also broadened her appeal quite significantly.
So she did actually do a lot more than Conlon did to try to appeal to people who were sitting there waiting, going, is she credible? I don't really want to vote for Conlon, but I will if she turns out to be a flake. And she didn't. And they said, you know, gosh, not only is she not a flake, she's getting all these other endorsements.
And on the flip side, what we saw is that, Conlon, and this is kind of a traditional strategy for somebody who's an incumbent and feels they were in the lead, really kept a very low profile the last month of the campaign.
Which is weird.
It's not weird if you feel, like you're playing defense, that you uh-huh. don't want to make any mistakes and just keep a low profile and assume that your name recognition and you know, established base in the community will carry you to victory. But as happens in sporting events sometimes, you know, where a team has a lead late and they start playing conservative, and guess what? The other side catches up. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, sports analogies don't always work in politics, but in this case it does. So.
Yeah. Fortunately, Ed Murray didn't do that. Because in the mayor's race, Murray took a pretty strong initial lead against McGinn in the double digits, around 13-14%. McGinn's been making that up some in the late returns. It's now down to single digits, but you know, he's not going to be able to catch Murray. Murray, it looks like, is going to be our next mayor.
It's way too much of a lead for that.
And what I found kind of interesting in the Murray McGinn race is what McGinn said, or what Murray said right after the election. Murray came out and said, well, you know, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to start a search for a new police chief. And I just thought, you know what? This didn't come up a whole lot during the campaign.
It didn't, did it?
It didn't come up at all. But, you know, it was one of the main reasons I voted for Murray, was because McGinn has had all this time to find a new police chief for the police department, and yet he hasn't lifted a finger, and there was no money set aside in his budget to do that, which to me really was the determining factor.
I think if McGinn had been reelected, we would have just seen the interim chief rolled over to become the permanent chief.
Without a serious search. Yeah, which to me just says, you know, you're happy with business as usual at the Seattle Police Department, which has been McGinn's take all along.
Yeah, that was the main reason why I couldn't bring myself to support McGinn, even though he was very strong on some other issues. His handling of the police department was just atrocious. Murray has said, and again, what politicians say on the campaign trail may or may not line up with what they actually do, but he said he's going to forge much stronger relationships with community and neighborhood groups than McGinn by and large did, and that includes taking critics of the police department seriously. And that is something that did not ever happen during the McGinn years.
Yeah.
In terms of the late returns, one that has not gone the way that a lot of folks might have wanted it to was the Good Jobs Initiative Proposition 1 in SeaTac. That had a 54-46 margin, very similar to the Sawant Conlon one on election night, but it's been trending in the other direction because, of course, the Washington Restaurant Association and Alaska Airlines and some other corporate interests poured huge amounts of money into that suburb of Seattle. SeaTac, the city, only has about 25,000 residents, and the opponents of that initiative spent something like $5 or $6 per person, not per voter, per person, in order to defeat that initiative. And so the late ballots have been trending in the other direction. The saving grace to that is that once again it's going to go down to challenged ballots and that sort of thing. And in that case, SEIU, which is the organization that was the major pro push behind
Service Employees International Union,
exactly, says they have a list of about 100 people, which doesn't sound a lot like a lot, but in a city of 25,000, it is, in a very close race, whose ballots have been challenged, who they are almost certain are yes votes. So they're feeling somewhat optimistic that they'll pull that out, but it's going to be very, very close. And, of course, huge amounts of corporate money at the state level doomed I-522, which is a serious object lesson in $1
GMO
one vote
initiative.
Exactly. Rachel Maddow had a thing the day before the election that of the $22 million that was spent by the anti-522 folks, 550 of it was in state. Not 550,000,
$550.
The rest of it was all from Monsanto, PepsiCo, you know, all the Dow, all the different chemical and agribusiness and
Conagra.
Food, companies, not that there's a significant difference between those three categories anymore, that didn't want you to know what's going into the stuff that you put in your body. And as happened with a similar initiative in California last year, they were successful. It's very, very discouraging.
Yeah, and I think it also points to the fact that folks who are for labeling initiatives really kind of have their work cut out for them. It's something that that people should not quit on. You need to get out there and educate Americans about the corporate agriculture system and about food quality issues and what these genetically modified organisms are doing, not just to potentially doing not just to their bodies, but particularly what they're doing to agricultural land, because, you know, the supply of farmland is not increasing. It is actually dwindling. And these crops that have been genetically modified to resist the use of the Roundup pesticide has led to a lot of pesticide-resistant weeds that have made large parts of U.S. agricultural land unfarmable, because these weeds are big enough to stop combines. And there are farmers who have given up on their farmland because they've used these genetically modified seeds, and it has changed the nature, their ability to actually farm their land. That's something that folks who are for labeling, who are against genetically modified food crops, should be out there telling the American people, look, food prices are going to go up using these genetically modified organisms because the supply of farmland is dwindling.
Yeah, especially with climate change coming in. And, of course, we'll talk when we talk about the farm bill a little bit later about where that disappearing farmland is going and who owns it now. But that's a different issue.
Yeah, because I think that's what most people were responding to when they voted against 522, is they didn't want to see their grocery bill go up.
Yeah.
Well, your grocery bill's going to go up.
There was also a weakness that I think created some no votes in terms of a lot of the exceptions, and the fact that it was kind of a confusingly written. If it had been more broadly written, I think that might have helped too.
Yeah.
But again, the money was the huge issue. And then finally, we got to move on because a lot of other things happened this week too. But the districts passed for Seattle City Council. It's now seven districts and two at-large seats as of the 2015 election. And a lot of people on the council now will be up for re-election in 2015. There are three pairs of current city council members who live in the same district. Nick Licata and Michael Bryan live in the same district. Sally Clark and Bruce Harrell live in the same district in southeast Seattle. And Sally Bagshaw and Tim Burgess live in the same district. So there's only two at-large seats, so one of those three pairs is not going to be able to win an at-large seat. Now, Nick Licata and Tim Burgess have both already said they're going to run citywide. That leaves Sally Clark and Bruce Harrell as the question about that. We also had on Wednesday, when corporate media had thought he would won, Richard Conlon coming out and saying that he wasn't going to run in 2015 because he would have had to run in the same district as Shama Sawant again. So he said, well, I'll sort out my 2 years and retire because I don't want to put my family through that again. Well, lucky Richard.
A real race.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of just
he's actually forced to defend his record.
Yeah.
So, but luckily for Richard, he may not have to put his family through that again earlier. So.
And then I want to talk a little bit about elections in Whatcom County. We tend not to pay much attention to the other counties in the state and to other things going on in other localities. But the county council elections in Whatcom County are particularly important for folks who are against the coal trains. There was a slate of candidates that were challenging the usual pro-development slate that typically gets elected in Whatcom County. And a lot of those folks are pretty much guaranteed. They didn't campaign on this issue because once elected to the county council, they have to be impartial when it comes to looking at these development issues. They didn't campaign against the coal trains, but it looks like they may be voting against them when the permits come up, because the Cherry Point Terminal will be built north of Bellingham in Whatcom County, and they'd have to issue permits for that and issue permits for the coal trains to pass through. And the Whatcom County Council is a 7-member body. From recent returns, it looks like about 4 of those seats could go to folks who were challenging the pro-development slate. So that could put a kibosh on the whole Cherry Point coal terminal, which would be expected to export about 48 million tons of coal from the United States to China.
Yeah, so that's
if it gets built. So that's good news.
Yeah, that's definitely good news. Mm-hmm. There was also a study that came out this week by a guy named Dean Jaffe, who's a professor of atmospheric and environmental chemistry at UW-Bothell. And this may seem intuitive, but it's actually good to spell this out scientifically, because the pro-coal terminal and coal train folks have been denying this, that, shocker of shockers, passage of more coal trains spreads more coal dust on nearby neighborhoods. Who would have thought? Jaffe looked at more than 450 freight coal and passenger trains from research stations in Seattle and down in the Columbia River Gorge to document what should be intuitively obvious. What he found was that a significant increase in large particles in the air was found when coal trains passed by compared with other types of trains reported. If the Cherry Point terminal is built, there will be an estimated 18 coal trains a day, each a mile to a mile and a half long, spewing that stuff not just along the Seattle waterfront, but also up through, you know, Edmonds, Mukilteo, Everett, Marysville, Bellingham, et cetera. It'd have some impact.
Yeah, and not only coal dust, too. He also noted in his study that coal trains, because they're pulling a heavy load, spew out a lot more diesel fumes as well. Yeah. Diesel fumes are not good, not only for your health, but also not good for the environment in general.
Yeah, and it does kick up secondary dust as well.
Yeah.
And wasn't that the study that was funded by crowdsourcing, because they couldn't get the funding from
It was primarily funded by a UW grant that came out of a fund that's set up for independent research that can't get funding from industry or from the government. Uh-huh. So it was definitely an independent study in the terms of how it was funded.
I wonder why they had trouble.
A different study then.
I wonder why they had trouble getting funding. I can't imagine.
I know.
All right, and then Sue Peters won her race.
Yes, we should mention that too. She did great, and she finally was able to claim victory yesterday.
For school board race
against a charter schools proponent who had a lot of money. I mean, records amount of money for a school board race. So that was great to see. Also, congratulations, Sue. And disclosure, she's a friend of mine too, and we talked during the course of the campaign. So.
All right, so moving on, a couple different funding issues, both bus cuts and Boeing.
Yeah.
Oh, special session, yeah.
Governor Inslee called a special session of the state legislature for Boeing. Yes, you know, it took Boeing saying that it would move production of the 777X to another state for state politicians to get together and say, gosh, maybe we should consider passing a transportation bill. As it turns out, the transportation bill is no longer on the slate. Instead, they're going to look at a whole collection of tax exemptions and subsidies for Boeing, including an extension of a commercial airplane tax incentive, which is due to expire in 2024. They want to extend it to 2040.
And what are the chances that Boeing is actually going to have any facilities left in Puget Sound in 2024?
They want to expand a sales and use tax exemption on buildings used to build super efficient airplanes. Boeing wants them to extend it to all commercial airplanes and to companies that build airplane wings and fuselages, so Boeing's suppliers as well. And they want them to simplify the permitting process for building on manufacturing sites. In total, the subsidies for Boeing would come up to about $9 billion over the course of the lifetime of those exemptions and other subsidies. So I think it's really ironic that Inslee could call a special session of the legislature. They're not going to consider a $10 billion transportation package because, you know, there's no money in the budget. But yes, they're going to consider a $9 billion package of tax breaks for Boeing.
Yeah, well,
for a corporation that's not even a Washington State corporation anymore.
Yeah, well, some pigs are more equal than others. A couple things on that. Speaking of Boeing, contract talks with the machinist union, because of course in part of the candy store that Boeing wants is a new contract with the machinists with a lot of concessions, even though Boeing is, surprise, surprise, quite profitable. And those contract talks appear to be falling apart. A Thursday night union meeting with the proposal from Boeing was dominated by discussion opposing the contract. In fact, District 751 President Tom Robluski, I think is how it's pronounced, ripped a copy of the proposal in half, vowing to try and have it withdrawn. Inslee naturally is siding with Boeing. And then, meanwhile, the reason that...
And I think that new contract would really deeply cut benefits at,
yes.
at Boeing. It would take back a wage increase that they had agreed on. It would take away the pension program and replace it with a 401k.
Yeah, and take away a lot of health benefits, too.
Yeah, take away a number of their health benefits. So it's a pretty severe change for them.
And again, Boeing is extremely profitable. There's no reason to do this other than that they're flexing their muscles and you know, they think they can.
And I think the contract also says that Boeing reserves the right to, even if they agree to start production of the 777X here in Puget Sound, to move it at any time.
Yeah, it does.
So Boeing's saying, here, sign this labor agreement, and we'll stay if we think it's okay. Will stay if you sign the agreement.
Yeah, it's like, and what's in it for you? Well, actually nothing, but other than maybe you can keep your job.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the reason they're not considering a transportation bill so that those Boeing workers can actually, you know, get to their jobs if they still have them. Senate Republican leader Mark Schosler and the Republicans in the Senate, which of course control the Senate agenda at this point, are the major roadblock to that, says he believes that Inslee is just trying to apply pressure to in terms of a transportation bill that, quote, "We've taken the position that the most important thing is to get it right and get it right for the entire state of Washington. To put that in an artificial timeline doesn't get it right." Well, you know, 17% cuts to Metro are not an artificial timeline. They are a very real timeline. And even more to the point, because it's a statewide consideration, is we're talking about a transportation budget for last year's budget. That is something that the state legislature is obligated to produce under the terms of the state constitution. And so, you know, if you don't feel like honoring your oath of office...
That's a very set timeline.
Yeah, and if you don't feel like honoring your oath of office, maybe you should, you know, find another job or something.
Yeah, meanwhile, King County Metro Transit says it will have to cut 74 bus routes. That's eliminate 74 bus routes and reduce service on another 100 routes. Those changes would affect 80% of all of its routes. And if you go on the King County website to look at the proposed changes, I tell you, it is going to be a big problem for people who rely on Metro Transit. Some of the routes they're cutting are pretty vital, and some of the ones that they're reducing service on in the evenings in particular are ones that are heavily traveled in the evenings.
Where it's already standing room only.
Yeah, 7 p.m. A lot of these routes, there won't be any service after 7 p.m. That's just not workable for people who work a swing schedule or work an evening job. And there are a lot of folks,
you know,
like
have a
in,
life.
In that situation. Yeah. So the state legislature needs to get on the stick and allow at least allow King County the ability to put a taxing initiative to the populace to fund Metro Transit.
All right. Moving on to national, trying to pound through these, the Federal Health Care Exchange.
Yeah, Kathleen Sebelius testified to the Senate Finance Committee this week that the Federal Health Care Exchange needs, quote, "a couple hundred fixes," end quote, which to me says that it's in way worse shape than we've known up to this point. When you've got a website that needs a couple hundred fixes, and every time you institute a bunch of fixes overnight, the next day there's more problems to fix, that tells me that at some point you may want to just scrap it and start over.
Yeah. Ask Microsoft how that works.
Yeah.
All right. And food stamps and
Fondo. Yeah, the food stamp cuts are kicking in. The money that was provided in the 2009 stimulus bill for food stamps is expiring, so a lot of people are going to, starting November 1st, saw cuts to their food stamps, and food banks are saying that they're starting to see much heavier traffic now. People who can't buy with food stamps are going to food banks, and the food banks are starting to run out. So if you're thinking about your giving this Christmas season, you may want to give some money or some food to local food banks.
Yeah, and I'll have an event on that kind of thing in a couple minutes.
In the meantime, the Environmental Working Group released a report this week showing that billionaires are receiving farm subsidies from the federal government. Now the food stamp funding is part of the farm bill, and the farm bill in recent years, it turns out, after the housing market collapsed in 2008, a lot of these big companies that owned a lot of residential real estate turned to buying up farmland. So a lot of the folks who get farm subsidies from the federal government these days are not mom and pop farmers. They are a lot of these big corporations. And among the list of billionaires who are getting farm subsidies, it includes folks like Paul Allen, Charles Schwab, the guy who started the big Charles Schwab investment company, and S. Truett Cathy, the owner of Chick-fil-A. He's also on the list of billionaires who received federal government subsidies. Now, the House Republicans, not only do they want to cut $40 billion from the food stamp program and kick at least 5 million people off the program altogether, they want to move federal farm subsidies from programs that require income limits into programs like crop insurance, which don't have income limits, so that more and more of these billionaires can receive federal government farm subsidies.
I don't think that's what they had in mind when they first started doing farm bills in like the 30s.
No.
Meanwhile, there was a report, and you had to go to the British media to find this because it got absolutely zero attention in U.S. media, but a report by the Task Force on Preserving Medical Professionalism and National Security Detention Centers this week, that basically said that doctors and psychologists working for the U.S. military not only violated ethical codes of their professions under instruction from the Department of Defense and CIA to help the torture and degrading treatment of suspected terrorists after 9/11, but that that treatment is still going on. After 9/11, health professionals, quote, designed and participated in cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment and torture of detainees, which is to say prisoners. Guess what? That's bad. Medical professionals were in effect told that their ethical mantra, first do no harm, did not apply, this is from the DOD, because they were not treating people who were ill. Maimed and dying, sure, but not ill, or maybe they were being made ill, or maybe they were being mistreated rather than treating. There's a number of ways you can parse that.
And that this is still going on in spite of the fact that that various medical professional associations have come out against their members participating in these interrogations that amount to torture, that folks are still doing it.
Yeah, and the DOD termed those involved in interrogation safety officers rather than doctors. So doctors and nurses were required to participate in the force feeding of prisoners in a hunger strike against the rules of both the World Medical Association and AMA. Doctors and psychologists working for the DOD were required to breach patient confidentiality and share what they knew of the prisoners' physical and psychological conditions. And they were also used as interrogators themselves. They also refused to comply with recommendations from the Army Surgeon General on reporting abuse of detainees. And the CIA's Office of Medical Services played a critical role in advising the Justice Department that enhanced interrogation methods like extended sleep deprivation and waterboarding, you know, things that are recognized as torture, were medically acceptable. I wonder if they're covered by Obamacare. So remind me again why nobody's been criminal charged over any of this ever. Oh, because we have to look forward, not backwards. So let's look forward. Unethical practices by medical personnel required by the military continue today. Direct quote. The DOD continues to follow policies that undermine standards of professional conduct for interrogation, hunger strikes, and reporting abuse. Protocols now require doctors and nurses to force feed prisoners, kidnappees, detainees, whatever you want to call them, including forced extensive bodily restraints for up to 2 hours, two times a day. And doctors are still required to give interrogators access to medical and psychological information about detainees, which they can use to exert pressure. And detainees are not permitted to receive treatment for the distress caused by their torture. So they're being forced to do everything basically except actually treat the prisoners. Now,
events.
A number of them. As I mentioned earlier, today and tomorrow at 11 o'clock, there will be trainings for folks who want to help the Shama Sawant campaign track down challenged ballots. It really is a fascinating procedure. That'll be at the Sawant campaign headquarters at, 1265 South Main, Suite 205. That's the corner of Main and 14th, just north of Jackson, for their voter protection campaign. Or you can check the website or call Devin at 360-507-1321. on Wednesday night, November 13th, 6:30, Who Stole the American Dream and What Labor Can Do to Get It Back, with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Hendrik Smith. That'll be at the Seattle Labor Temple, 2800 First at Broad in Belltown. And finally, next Thursday, the 14th of November at 7 o'clock, The Spirituality of Social Justice with Jim Berklow. That's the latest installation of the Common Good Cafe, University Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. So you'll be busy.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish, Maria Tomchick, both of Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.